Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to another episode of Talk with Tenny. I want to thank you for listening in. If you'd like to call into the show, the number is area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. I want to start off by reminding people about a couple of events that are coming up in the near future. Tomorrow, I will be presenting with Seth Farber and others at the Left Forum at John Jay College. Our workshop is at 3 o'clock. It's entitled The Anti-Psychiatry Movement's Challenge to the Left, Saz, Lang, and the MAD Movement. On June 19th, in front of Kings County Hospital Center Psychiatric Emergency Room, there will be a demonstration and vigil held in remembrance of Esmond Green, who was murdered there in 2008 and left on the emergency room floor to die and languish. You may remember the videotape of this. The staff, would look in and walk away. Ms. Green was lying face down on the floor of an emergency room. The security guard you see at one point rolling his chair over, looking at her, rolling away. It was all captured on video. And so June 19th will be the six-year anniversary of Ms. Esmond's Green's murder, and we will be holding vigil and in remembrance for anyone else who has been lost their life to psychiatry. July 13th at 6 p.m. through July 16th at 6 p.m., the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance will be hosting the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day demonstration and vigil. It will be on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health from 6 p.m. to 6 p.m. For 72 hours. And we sit vigil for 72 hours because that is how long anyone can be detained, assessed, and treated and being determined for whether or not they're going to, whether or not they were going to be institutionalized. And so that will be July 13th through the 16th in Albany, New York. And then July 24th through the 27th in Connecticut will be the Mind Freedom International's Creative Revolution Conference, and that is going to be a really interesting 3 days where people will be exploring alternatives and developing newfound connections with each other about how to further our experiences and get our voices heard and, find, as the conference says, creative revolution to the problems that as a society we are facing. And so those are a few of the things that are coming up. Yesterday we talked about the Murphy Bill and the hearings that had been being held without much notice, or at least I didn't get any notice of the hearings, where they were supposed to be reporting on the investigation that Murphy made into the public mental health system. And as it turns out, the people that they had, you can see this on C-SPAN, it was published on May 29th, 2014, called Mental Illness Report. The C-SPAN's little blurb about it says, Representative Tim Murphy, Republican, Pennsylvania, chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee's Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee, held a briefing on the subcommittee's report on its investigation of federal programs that address severe mental illness. Topics included a bill to overhaul the current mental health system sponsored by Representative Murphy and a competing bill sponsored by Representative Ron Barber, Democrat, Arizona. Representative Murphy, a practicing clinical psychologist, was joined in responding to questions by a forensic psychiatrist, a mental health advocate, and a father whose son suffers from schizophrenia. And it was unfortunate, or it is unfortunate, that in the hearing there was maybe 3 minutes paid attention to the findings of the report, and the rest of the time was pretty much propaganda for the expanded use of involuntary outpatient commitment laws and involuntary outpatient psychiatry, people who are assigned a psychiatric label, laws that would support the involuntary involvement with psychiatry. And so it was a lot of propaganda, is what it was. If you'd like to call in, the area code is 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. So in this little propaganda fest that Congressman Murphy held today, there was statement made that by the psychiatrist that something about the disrespect for psychiatry and what it has accomplished is part of why there is a stigma against people who have psychiatric histories. And, of course, stigma is the language that they use, but stigma is really about discrimination and prejudice that people who are psychiatrically labeled face. As we've talked about on this show repeatedly, psychiatry presents itself as a valid science that is rested in actual medicine. And there is not that kind of evidence for it. In, you know, the one sentence, they will say that someday we may find some biological, you know, insight into this. But then they act as if that day has already arrived. And so there isn't the validity. Even INSO, the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, said that the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, the DSM-5, lacks is validity and reliability. And so there is a mismessage that society is getting from the media, from pharmaceutical industry, through commercials, that is through textbooks that psychology or students are learning from freshman year. They're instructed that there's some kind of science going on here. But when you ask anybody who's been diagnosed with a psychiatric label whether or not they have ever had a blood test or if there was some kind of confirmation of this, there is no confirmation. There is no blood test. The National Institute of Mental Health is clear. There is no blood test. There is no brain scan. There is no genetic testing that can be done. What is labeled psychiatric are things that are observable, and the creation of these diagnoses are literally done by a vote of people based on a, you know, cluster of quote-unquote symptoms of different ways in which people behave or experience reality. And I think that we really need to question whether or not the loss of civil liberties for people in the United States is justifiable based on the actions of a very few people who did horrendous things. No one is, I certainly am not justifying or, you know, giving any kind of praise to people who commit mass murder. I'm not advocating for them, but that is criminal. That is criminal, and it was with intent, and it was planned out, and it was very much intentional. And those are not, that is not who the majority of people that we are talking about when we talk about people who are psychiatrically labeled and affected by state-sponsored services are not generally young, rich, white men who are overwhelmingly on SSRIs. These are not who who is doing this, and it's not who's subjected to these laws. It's the average person subjected to these laws is somebody who is economically challenged, involved with the state system, overwhelmingly overrepresented by people of color. African Americans are 3 to 8 times more likely to be court-ordered into involuntary outpatient commitment than whites, 5 times more likely statewide. That's significant. And when the legislature in New York commissioned a study to find out what was actually going on, the numbers that were reproduced was that African Americans are 3 to 8 times more likely to be court-ordered, 5 times more likely statewide. And buried on page 32 of the Duke study is the reason, because the people who are part of the qualifying for people who are under this law is that you have to have been institutionalized twice in the last 36 months. And so they said that the Duke study said that there is clear overrepresentation of people of color in institutions. And so that's in part why people of color are overrepresented in involuntary outpatient commitment. And this is a major problem. This is institutional and structural racism working through. Even the Duke study said whether you see involuntary outpatient commitment as helpful to a group that is oppressed or a further infringement on their civil liberties is dependent on whether or not you see psychiatry as a good thing. And if you are the average person who's only been exposed to psychiatry in terms of what the media is telling you, what the pharmaceutical ads are telling you, maybe what a textbook you may have read is in a Psych 100 class, then you may think that psychiatry has something to offer. But all psychiatry offers is drugs and institutions, social control and poisoning of people. It's the NASHBED, National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, in, I think it was 2008, put out a report, the commonly called the Morbidity Mortality Study, that shows a 25 to 30-year loss of life for people who are in public psychiatric systems who have been diagnosed with a, quote, serious mental illness, end quote. And so a 25 to 30-year loss of life puts somebody who's involved with psychiatry at the end of their life at around, 40 years old, 50 maybe. 25 to 30 years taken from your life. But this is the same thing as like when they say, oh, well, maybe electroshock only wipes out 30% of your memory. Well, which 30%? And how is that something that is justifiable for somebody to not be given informed consent and to be used on somebody against their will and over their objection? If you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. Speaking of electroshock, on Wednesday, June 4th, 2014, from 8 to 10 p.m., there's going to be a special episode of Talk with Tenny. It's going to be Electroshock, a Crime Against Humanity. And we're going to have several really phenomenal guests on that night, including Sue Clark Wittenberg, Don Weitz, George Ebert, John Breeding, Brenda LaFrancois, and Loretta Wilson, who has been doing some incredible work around the FDA, trying to figure out what level that this ETT device itself is going to be at. They're trying to drop it from a level 3 experimental device to a level 2 device, which would make the ECT machine that generates the shock as safe as a pair of eyeglasses or a wheelchair. And while many people went and testified at the hearings, and there's some video, YouTube videos of that up on my video channel, which I think is Lauren10E on YouTube. a most remarkable thing happened, that of all of the people who were on the panel to make a decision as to whether yes or no to drop the device level from a level 3 to a level 2, the only people who voted to drop the level without safety and efficacy testing were the psychiatrists who were using it and the device maker themselves. And so it's interesting that all of the other doctors, neurologists, ophthalmologists on the panel all saw why the ECT device should remain a level 3 device as an experimental device that's never been tested for efficacy or safety and is actually thought to be unethical to test for such a thing. And yet the psychiatrists and the device makers want to drop this standard to a level 2 so that they can continue doing it. And so it's this continued scam. And so we're going to be talking about things from the perspectives of people who actually have survived electroshock and also from the perspectives of some psychologists who are working to end the use of these practices. And so it should be a really interesting show. That's June 4th from 8 to 10 p.m. on the Blog Talk Radio, Talk with Tenny. If you'd like to call in, the area code's 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. There's a couple of people on the line. If you are wanting to talk, your line is open.
Hi, Lauren.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I was listening to you about the morbidity report, and I'm going to post it on Facebook at some point, but I got an article sent to me about all of the different killings of people and how prescription drugs played a part in it. And I'm just wondering if we could attack psychiatry, the Murphy Bill, and saying that these drugs are what causes violence, what causes, physical illness if you're on it for a long time, I don't know if that's the greatest strategy, but I just feel like we need to do more than we're doing,
I think the people desperately need to be informed about this, especially the link to the SSRIs and violence. It clearly says on the warning label, a black box warning label was put on these drugs, that these may cause suicidality and it causes aggression. And suicide is anger and aggression toward inward. Homicide is anger and aggression toward outward. And people need to be aware of that link between the SSRIs and these mass shootings. And then couple issues of all of these young people were involved with psychiatry. Psychiatry does not have the answers. And so I think that the more we can tell people about these kinds of things, if you would share that on my page, I'd really appreciate that.
Oh, sure, I will. I'll send the link.
I appreciate it. And I think, 25, 30-year loss of life, that is a long time that people could be alive that is being robbed from them. And robbed from them in the years of their life, the physical effects of these drugs, it's not like one day they just die 25 to 30 years sooner. These drugs make people terribly physically ill. Diabetes, metabolic syndrome, kidney,
and
liver.
And dialysis. I've known people that have been on lithium for a long time. You shouldn't be on it too long. And now they're on dialysis.
Right.
I think that's awful,
It really is, and it's creating huge medical cost in other arenas, robbing people's health and their ability to sometimes even move. Some people have become so tardive dyskinesia or neuroleptic malignant syndrome, and these things can literally stop one in their tracks. And then the sedative properties of the drugs, where their goal is to subdue you so that you don't move. And people's lives are being robbed. And Celia, I don't know if you saw the video that came out from yesterday's hearings with Jaffe.
Oh, no, I have to look. Oh, he makes me so crazy. I'm sorry to say that word. Oh, my, it just makes me so angry.
It really is criminal. I mean, and I want to say, like, they had a Edward Kelly was there, who's the father of somebody who has been diagnosed.
Yeah.
And I'm not unfeeling to families in saying any of this, and I'm not even saying that, you know, some kind of, like, if psychiatry had something valuable to offer, people would not reject it in the way that they do. And that's very hard to get somebody who's so emotionally involved in a situation to understand that the damage that is done. So I don't want to really talk about him, but who I'd like to talk about, Edward Kelly, I mean, but who I'd like to really, like, get the public to understand is that this DJ Jaffe, who announced himself as an uber liberal and said at one point that he's as liberal as they come, that Democrats need to understand that this is what is necessary to do. And so it is horrifying to me that people who may be liberal or have a liberal view about how the world is are now the next group that is being targeted by this message. They are directly naming liberals as the people that need to understand that, quote-unquote, mental illness is real and that they're in denial and that, you know, what people are dying, you know, 6 feet under with their rights kind of messaging.
Yeah.
And it's so damaging because very few realize that that these laws, the way that they're written, and certainly the way that they will be used once Affordable Care Act gets kicked in and everybody is mandated to mental health and substance use screenings. People don't realize that this is coming down the pike, but your physician is going to be mandated to do mental health screenings and substance use screenings on you under the Affordable Care Act. And this is part of what Patrick Kennedy has been pushing, and he calls a checkup from the neck up.
Gosh. But where is this video? Is it on your page?
It's. I think it's on my page, but it's definitely on C-SPAN, and it's the report, the mental illness report, it's called. And it was published May 29th. It was published yesterday, and so. So there's that issue with Jaffe putting this out. And, you know, so he's saying that it's really only about 4% of people who are psychiatrically labeled that he's talking about that these laws go after. And he said it's
but it is going to affect everybody in the public, whether they were diagnosed or not.
Of course it is. Of course it is. And he says that people don't fear that this is of that this thing is unconstitutionality. He says, "Don't not support this because you fear it's unconstitutional." Their newest stance is that this is the greatest protection to people and their rights. That they have the right to treatment. That they have the right to be forced. And that it's our moral obligation as a society to force people on these drugs. And that is the current messaging coming out of Jaffe and Murphy. I want to just give the number real quick. It's area code 267-521-0167. If you're listening and want to call in and want have something to say about what we're talking about or you want to talk about something else, give a call, area code 267-521-0167. Jaffe literally said that peer support and trauma-informed care are not effective, that they are not evidence-based practices, that they don't, you know, prevent crimes, that they don't prevent deaths, that they don't prevent these things.
Wow.
They're, you know, that they are now making a full-on attack on trauma-informed care and on peer support. And so for anybody out there who may be working in the peer industry, who may be, somebody who's supporting trauma-informed initiatives, first, they are evidence-based. Isn't that correct?
Yeah.
And so that's one issue that people need to be aware of. But another major thing is that if the Murphy bill passes and the federal SAMHSA is wiped out, and what they want to wipe out is all kinds of alternative programs, the minority fellowships, the alternatives conference, any advocacy, the protection and PAMI, all the PAMI boards, the protection and advocacy for individuals with, quote, mental illness, they want to wipe all of that out. And if they wipe all of that out, so the people who are directly affected and getting funding through those organizations and agencies, all of the PAMI lawyers, you know, wherever you're looking in any of these situations, all of their jobs are going to be gone immediately. And then once the federal SAMHSA regulations of recovery-based and alternatives kind of supports, not that they're anti-psychiatry at all, because it's ludicrous that they can call SAMHSA anti-psychiatry, but any kind of alternative or complementary kind of thing that SAMHSA has been supporting, including trauma-informed care, all of those standards are going to be gone from the federal government. So states are no longer going to have to comply with these federal regulations, because these regulations are going to be wiped out. So
yeah.
It's not just people who are working at the national level that need to be worrying about this, but it will turn our entire system back to 30 plus years ago of where there was no involvement of people at the table, at the policymaking tables, no support for alternatives, no support for advocacy for people. These are really big issues that I don't think people are. I don't know if they're just so overwhelmed by the constant onslaught of having to defend what it is being done, or just uninterested, or don't realize the depth. But anybody who's working in these the peer industry or advocacy needs to be aware that if this changes at the federal level, everything at the state level is going to change also.
So what do you think what is our strategy to fight this? I know that a variety of people have been fighting this, Leia Harris and others.
Some work has been done. There's an alternative bill that's been put out as an alternative to it, the Ron Barber bill, which is something like supporting mental health community crises in the community or something. I think that more legislation, we're legislated to death. How much more legislation do we need? That we really need to be focusing on stopping this from happening and not necessarily introducing more ways that we can ultimately be controlled by them. But the doctor, this forensic psychiatrist that they had on the panel with Jaffe and Edward Kelly and Murphy, it was really literally scary that the way that he presented the quote-unquote denial that everybody is in about the existence of these of psychiatry being good, and that people need to accept that psychiatry is good, and that the stigma comes from the idea that psychiatry is disrespected, and that it hasn't been given credit for its accomplishments. And he actually said at one point that if only the federal government would spend the money on advertising psychiatry the way they spent money on advertising the Affordable Care Act, that maybe then people would have an idea about how much psychiatry has to offer. It's the idea of a true civil liberties issue of somebody being able to make a phone call about you, and which necessitates the police to show up at your house and take you for 72 hours to be detained and evaluated and treated. People think that they're going to escape this and that this is not about them. But all you need is, you know, one loss of one job and you're not able to pay your bills for, you know what I mean? How many people are living check to check? And then all of a sudden your behaviors come under suspect because you can't afford yourself. And that so much of the base of these issues is money, not mental health or whatever.
Right.
And so it's pretty frustrating in many ways that this is where we're at right now and what it is we have to fight. I don't know that I know the answers. If you're listening and you have some ideas, call in area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. I think, Celia, I'm wondering, would you talk a little bit about Mind Freedom and then also a little bit about Mind Freedom's conference coming up?
Yeah, well, we're very excited about the conference that you mentioned earlier, July 24th to 27th at Wisdom House in Litchfield, Connecticut. One of the things we're doing, we just sent out a scholarship letter because we'd like other people to come who really can't afford it. And so we'd like people to donate so some people will be able to attend.
Oh, that's great.
It's on the Mind Freedom Facebook page and some other pages on Facebook. We've added commuter rates. Wisdom House is charging $35 for lunch and dinner, $51, and for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, $61. And so we're asking to add a registration fee of $40 for one day to the commuter rate and $80 for 2 days and $125 if you're there for more than 2 days. And that's what people are paying for the full time they're there. And the conference includes room and all meals and registration fee. So you don't have to pay it separate. And it's going to be really, really exciting. So I'm hoping people will donate. I'm hoping people will. We still have room left. So we have shared rooms, shared baths. We are out of single rooms. But it's a retreat center, so we can all be together and network.
That's great.
Yeah.
Can you talk
a
little bit about like what kinds of things people could expect of happening there when they get there? Is there schedule?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we're working on the schedule, but we've decided to have experts instead of having workshops, we're having work groups where people who have been doing programs like Soteria House can come and talk about how that was developed, how to expand it. We have peer-run respite, and then a program called Sunrise Center, withdrawing from psychiatric drugs.
Oh, what's that about?
Well, Janet Foner has been working on this for years and trying to get funding, not from the government, to help people get off of psych drugs, and it's called the Sunrise Center. It's not fully developed yet, but they've been doing a lot of fundraising and meeting about it, so hopefully we'll see that in the future. So that'll be a work group.
That's great. Could you also just talk a little bit about what Soteria House is for people who may not be familiar with
it? Well, Soteria House was developed by the late Warren Mosier. And it was a way for people to go to a home-like setting where they could just be in an altered state without any meds and be in a comfortable environment with their peers and just heal for as long as they can. And there are a couple of Soteria houses. You know, Soteria Alaska, Susan Masante is going to be there. And Stephen Morgan from Soteria, Vermont.
Great.
To discuss that. I think this is a really good model where people aren't using drugs, you know.
Great.
So that'll happen. And we have the Hearing Voices Network, which has been really popular for people. So
could you talk a little bit about what you know about that also, the Hearing Voices Network?
Well, it's been an international network, and it's really that voice of hearing voices, you know, voice hearers cannot, they don't have to be ashamed of hearing voices or visions or, you know, expressions. That they're around people who understand it and work to support each other rather than, again, using medication to suppress it, but really learn from it and help other people, you know, because sometimes it's scary for people. They don't feel they can control it. It doesn't really always go away, and that's okay. You know, it's a way to just work together to support each other. We do have a Hearing Voices USA now. I don't know how totally it's developed, but it's there. So
that's great.
Yeah, so that's going to be exciting. Then we have Robert Whitaker, keynote speaker, and Mary Ellen Copeland. So we're very excited about them. Yeah.
Yeah, Robert Whitaker and Mary Ellen Copeland both have come up quite a bit on the show over its existence as two people who are offering stuff that are good and that people should be exposed to. And so, Robert Whitaker, what's he going to be talking about?
You know, I don't even know. we're still working on that. I'm sure he has a lot of exciting things that he can share with us. So.
For people who may not know, he's a prize-winning medical journalist who wrote several articles and books. My two favorite are Mad in America and Anatomy of an Epidemic. And he really has done a phenomenal job in exposing so much of the many of the problems of the current psychiatric system and detailing it back through history. His work is really phenomenal, and he shows that psychiatric drugs aren't necessarily good and can actually be harmful, and links it to the explosion of the SSRIs, if I'm right, back in the
80s.
The pharmaceutical growth and the rate of growth of disability in this country, because people are getting into the system and they're being told you're no longer allowed to work. You have to go on SSI and or SSDI, and they're being prevented from working. And so, you know, sometimes people can't get like their heads around the numbers that we're talking about. That there are like hundreds of thousands of people in New York, for example, who are receiving, you know, state-sponsored psychiatric services, and at billions of dollars a year, it's about over $4 billion, so that's like a huge amount of money and a huge amount of people that are being affected. Mm-hmm. But the loss to society, in terms of our economy, for people being prevented from being able to work, in terms of just the contribution that people can make as in citizenship and such, activities of being part of a community, of people being welcomed, that there are hundreds of thousands of people who are cast out of society because of this, and it is a huge loss to our culture and our existence. And
I agree. This is probably for another time, but I just think we need to think about alternative funding for a lot of these things if we want people to be, you know, out of the system, you know, creating their own way of wellness. It's just so critical now. I don't know.
And that's something that Mind Freedom has always really, Mind Freedom International has always been an independent organization. You don't take money from
pharmaceutical government
or churches, right? Yeah.
No, we don't. You know, we rely on donations and membership dues. So,
right.
So
people can find the Mind Freedom website at mindfreedom.org.
And it's right on the front if you want to register or learn more about the conference.
And so what if
I'm
somebody who just happens to be listening to the show and I haven't been involved with anything and I've never been involved in the movement. I've just been somebody who's, you know, do I have to, like, have known people or do be involved in order to go to this conference?
No. This is why I'm trying to get scholarship funding for people. We want people who've never been in the movement, who just want to learn. We know the support's there. You know, they're healing, and we want them to be there, you know?
Right. And so it's going to be a really great mix of people. And, you know, I think when you guys did this, I guess it was 07 or 08, the last time you were in Connecticut?
Yeah, 2007, yeah.
2007,
yeah.
And
Judy was there, by the way, Judy Chamberlain.
So it was a fabulous experience. It's really a healing, energizing, fun, educational experience of where you can be around people who have had similar experiences to you and really learn and grow and make connections that are lasting.
Yes.
And it's not
and
just
Lauren,
a one-time
you're gonna be
thing.
There.
I will be there. I will be there.
Hopefully with Frank. We'll talk about that in
yes.
the coming weeks.
Yes, but it will be very exciting, and I think it's a good place for people to be able to get into something that is different than the usual messages that you get from you know, the psychiatric system. I just want to give out the
right.
number again.
Thank
if you're
you.
Listening. Yeah, it's area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. Yes, I think, could you talk a little bit, you know, one of the things that has come up on the show a couple of times is the Mind Freedom Shield Alert.
Yeah. You register as a document that you fill out on our website that if you're getting any kind of forced treatment, forced shock, that this alert now goes out to our volunteer list that people can advocate, you know, for the person. Sometimes we do. So we write the alert. We have people call. If you're in the hospital or call the governor's office or, you know, all these different people to support a person who's being forced to alert, the human rights alert. Jim Gottstein recently, he also takes the Mind Freedom Shield and creates an event on Facebook so that more people can be alerted to what's going on and they can get involved.
Right. Which I think that, you know, I've seen and been part of these. I write letters myself when they come up and I make phone calls. But one of the most amazing ones I think that I ever witnessed was Ray Sanford.
Yes. Yeah.
Would
that
you...
David Oakes was a part of that. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, he was getting something like 40 or so or more electroshock and decided he didn't want to do it anymore, so they got a court order. And this is outpatient electroshock.
And this was in Minnesota, right?
It was in Minnesota. And, you know, David really worked on this. I mean, he called, you know, he spoke to Ray and his family. He called the governor's office, the commissioner there. It was a big, big deal. And eventually, through his advocacy and all the other activists, he was able to stop getting electroshock. And that's what sometimes it takes, is activism, to bring this to the public. Like, you can't do this, you know?
And that was Governor Pawlenty, who I remember getting hung up on by his office administrator person, and writing letters to. And there are so many people that are Mind Freedom members that will support you through these kinds of processes. So if you're somebody who hasn't been connected in with advocates and don't know where to reach, Mind Freedom is a wonderful resource, as is psychrights.org, the law project for psychiatric rights, with Jim Gottstein, and doing phenomenal work around that. And so the membership at Mind Freedom has so many benefits, and
yeah.
I think people to get the message out about different ways that people can be involved and be part of a community, but also when you're in need, if you ever were in need, that there's a community of people there that are going to assist and write letters and make calls and make sure that your voice is being heard and respected. And I think that's something that so many of us don't have.
Yeah, and one thing I want to mention that's happening now with all of this going on with the Murphy's Bill, Laura's Law in California, I'm hearing we're getting an increase of calls, and we need lawyers. And I know that Jim Gottstein is on leave for a while, and he's just overwhelmed with too many. We always give our cases that are legal issues around psychiatry to Jim, and so we need to have some more lawyers that are willing to work on this, because we don't do legal work. We do activism. So if there's any lawyers out there that want to help out,
Yeah, mindfreedom.org if you're a lawyer. And, I think that this is an avenue that isn't explored too often, and really looking to the legal system to change some of these fundamental laws. But there are ways that one can successfully fight an involuntary treatment order, and with a good lawyer who is going to support you. And unfortunately, what we wind up getting is the public defender version of lawyers in mental hygiene and legal services. Some of them exceptional, like Kim Darrow and who's sorely missed, and Dennis Feld, and some do really good work, but unfortunately, the majority of it is cloaked inside of. Cloaked inside of this scam that is going on between the judges and the psychiatrists and the lawyers, and we're not really getting representation. So organizations like Mind Freedom that can provide a network of advocates are good to be aware of. One of the terms one of the terms I keep on hearing lately is this term called the black robe effect of the... The power that the judge has by simply making, even if they don't have the legal right to say to somebody, you must take drugs, the power that the costume of the black robe has to make people think that because the judge is saying it, that they must comply. And I think that that's something that to try to raise awareness, especially, you mentioned Laura's Law in California, and I think, another county, I think it's Orange County, just passed a version of that. So it's not in every county in California, but there are.
Right.
And it's becoming more widespread. And with the Murphy Bill, as I understand it, it's going to mandate, in order for states to get money from the federal government, they will need to have an involuntary outpatient commitment law in place. And so the four or five states that are remaining without them are going to have to put in involuntary commitment laws in order to get money from the federal government. And the standards are so loose. People really have in their heads that this is somebody else that this is happening to, and that it would never be them or somebody that they know. And it's just not accurate.
Well, this can happen to them. We should have a campaign. This can happen to you.
right. Exactly. I think that's great. This can happen to you. I think we should do that. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Because everyone is at risk. Everyone is at risk. And so if you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. And so how do you get the general population to understand that this is a major problem, that they're being lied to? And
well, I think we've done a lot of, you know, the protests. There were people that came up to me walking in the street. It was like, what this is about. And I was telling them about a Free Justina and, you know, the people are being forced into treatment. They said, oh, my God. And they're still doing electroshock. Like, they really don't even know that this is going on. So
right.
A lot of the grassroots talking to people and even my family are like, wow, they didn't even know what was going on. And they can spread the message around, too.
Right, like
you know?
my new tagline: you don't need to be mad to call in, but it helps, right? Like that, you don't have to be crazy to see that there's a problem with this. You don't have to. I mean, and then you get into all of these other slippery slope constitutional rights issues, of where every other group is making concessions to maintain the rights of their group by you know, on our backs. Okay, well, yeah, okay, so let's carve out people with psychiatric histories. So for everybody except people with psychiatric histories, we can still have our rights. But if you have a psychiatric history, that'll be the line that we draw. And there's so many people who have psychiatric histories, tens of millions of people who have been
yeah.
on these psychiatric drugs that people don't realize that, especially
mm-hmm.
with the medical records going electronic, medical records now, that if you did something 15 years ago, you were, you know, even postpartum depression, or, you know, you lost a loved one, or you had a really bad breakup, or you went through a spot in time of where, you know, you went and you sought help, that is on your, you know, that is on your permanent record, so to speak.
Yeah,
And I really think it's another reason why we're dying so soon, because people with psychiatric histories, like the same thing as what's happening with Justina, or what happened with Justina, with her having a medical diagnosis, a psychiatrist coming in and saying that the medical diagnosis was fraudulent and that what she had was somatoform disorder, which is a diagnosis that has zero scientific evidence of existence.
I have never heard of it. I've never heard of it. So
of somatoform?
Does it exist?
It's what you know. The hypochondrias fall under that. If you think you can feel your organs, that comes under that. If they say that, you know, it's in your head, that you're not really sick. It's just in your head. So they took her away from her parents. They put a gag order on her parents. They locked her up in an institution for over 15 months. She was on ice skates 2 years ago, a 15-year-old girl on ice skates, now having to use a wheelchair, having taken all of her actual medical treatment away from her. And who knows what she's experienced while she was in the psychiatric center. I called Boston Children's, the Department of Mental Health in Boston, the Boston Department of Family Children's Services, because she had managed to get a note out saying that she was being hurt there. And I filed human rights complaints. I filed a complaint with the police. Nobody responded. And when they did respond, they said that it wasn't their responsibility. It was this other, you know, organization's responsibility. And it was, you know, pass the potato around or whatever. And a judge putting a gag order that you're not allowed to be able to talk about what's happening to your daughter, and to have your child taken away from you because you don't want to comply with psychiatry, and then you're charged with medical neglect.
Yeah,
how many parents, when you could look at things like nutrition or activity or you know, trauma or any of these other things that have shown to be more likely to resolve things, and instead we're putting all these kids on drugs. We have no idea of what long-term ramifications of them are in children.
Mm-hmm.
We know in adults
mm-hmm.
that they shorten the life by 25 to 30 years, right? So what happens when you put a 2-year-old on Haldol, which is like...
It doesn't make sense, yeah.
How do you, as an ethical,
I don't know how you justify
person,
that.
They're two-year-olds. And yet they do. And because of the advertising and the marketing schemes of Big Pharma and all of this other stuff, they are just, you know, they are just raking in billions of dollars. Like, I saw the other day, Abilify is the top-selling drug, and it's made, like, $7 billion in its short existence. $7 billion
wow.
on one drug. And so when you
wow.
compare that to, like Viagra and Cialis make, like, $1 million or $2 million. $1 million or $2 billion. So there's, like when you compare, like, what drugs make, right? and like, a large portion of the top 10 drugs that are being sold in this country are psychiatric drugs. So when you say to somebody, oh, it's, you know, this law is only going to affect people who have a psychiatric history, if you've taken a psychiatric drug prescribed, you have a psychiatric history. And,
right.
and the average
right.
person doesn't put that in their head because they think that, you know, the quote-unquote mentally ill is somebody else. And they
right.
don't realize that it's them. And so they're constantly supporting these kinds of efforts by the government to further control our civil liberties and don't realize that they're setting up the gateway for us to all be just marched away.
Yeah.
And
well, there's a lot of work campaigns that we need to do. I could just and we're doing it. I'm not saying we're not. But we have more work to do.
So much work to do. So much
yeah.
work. And I really do like that idea of this could happen to you. I think that people...
Yeah, I think... I love that. Maybe
you know,
we can work on that. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
You know, over the past couple of weeks, I've been talking about a couple of... much more than a couple of murders that have occurred by people. I don't know if you saw the... I think we talked about the Michael Blair's murder in Texas.
I didn't really understand what happened. I did see it. He was murdered by police. Is that
by
correct?
The police, 11 shots, Celia. After he hit the ground, he hit in his family's bathroom, in his tub.
Oh my
so
God! Why did they do that?
This is what happens. The
mm-hmm.
The family, he was apparently he may have been suicidal or having some kind of extreme emotional. State.
Yeah.
His family was concerned about him. They called the hospital. The hospital refused them and told them to call 911. They were suspicious of the police. It was reported in the news. So they set up a hidden cell phone camera, which happened to be at the exact right angle to capture the 6 minutes, in under 6 minutes. The cop comes in, he's, open the door, looks at his watch, starts banging on the door. Mr. Blair finally opens the door a crack. The police officer yells he has a knife. Mr. Blair quickly shuts the bathroom door. The officer takes out his gun and kicks the door down, holding his gun into Michael Blair's. Remember, this is somebody who may have been suicidal or in some kind of extreme
yeah.
emotional state, right? So the most logical thing to do is whip out a gun and hold it in their face, right? And then he was tased multiple times, and the taser, it's my understanding that the taser broke, and so while they were trying to get another taser, Mr. Blair got up and looked like he was stumbling a little bit, which the officer has, I guess, reported that he felt that he was in fear of his life, and he let out 11 shots.
Are you kidding me? Really?
No. And it was all in under 6 minutes, Celia. And,
oh, my God.
And
oh
for the family,
God.
For the family of who has said that, you know, they wish they didn't call, that they had already been suspicious, which is why they had this. So I started making some phone calls, and I talked. This is all in Fort Bend, Texas, and I wound up their public information officer had been out when I called, and so I wound up talking to one of the captains, who probably told me more than he should have, and because he's not a public information officer and he doesn't understand. But he did clearly say that this was a justified shooting and that he stood by what these officers did. And so Yeah, so then I started calling around a little more, and I wound up talking with the district attorney in Fort Bend, who invited me to call him back on June 13th. We had a very good conversation. And because one of the things that the captain told me was that the grand jury had not seen the video. And Yeah.
They didn't put it into evidence.
Well, apparently, it's just come out within the incident happened in November, but this has just occurred recently where the video was released by the family because I think that they weren't getting what they needed to get. I'm not sure. I can't really talk for the family, but I'm just from what I've heard in the news, and you know, from that perspective. And so the DA told me that he couldn't say what the jury had been given or not given or what they would, but that the jury, the grand jury may be reconvened at the end of June. And he asked me to call him back. He said by June 13th, he should have better information about that. And so I will, you know, follow up with that. But I think that, you know, the idea that and this has gotten all kinds of attention on Facebook and all kinds of people, you know, really debating back and forth, and I hope in a respectful way. But the idea that calling the police, the police are the last people that should be involved in something that is revolving around an emotional crisis of somebody being called in. The police are authorities. They are they give commands, and commands are supposed to be followed. If there is nothing if there is nothing criminal going on, somebody who is contemplating ending their own life, banging on a door and yelling at them and holding a gun in their face, these are not good solutions for somebody. I mean, even if there was nothing going on, these are not good solutions for approaching somebody, right? But especially somebody who may be in an emotional crisis. And so the idea of the police being the people who, and I might add, Mr. Blair had a knife. The officer had a taser and a gun. And so why aren't we arming police with some kind of chainmail if they're dealing with it? Why are we putting resolving a situation with a knife with a gun? Why is this acceptable in 2014? And so there are so many, but there are so many people who are dying at the hands of psychiatry. Darren Rainey, another 50-year-old gentleman, it was in the paper, it was reported that he was cooked in his cell.
That I heard,
Bradley, I'm sorry, Darren Rainey, I am wrong. He was scalded, his skin. He was put into a shower as punishment, and apparently the video surveillance camera that caught the guard who put him into the shower somehow miraculously happened to malfunction at that point. So there's no videotape of this, but he had what Mr. Rainey had done was he defecated in his cell and he had not cleaned it up, and so the guards put him into a shower stall with scalding hot water until his skin boiled off and melted off of him.
Really cruel.
And then there was Bradley Ballard, who was put into solitary confinement and found dead in solitary confinement after 7 days. He was 39 years old. He was put in solitary confinement for making a lewd comment at a female guard for 7 days. And when they found him, his genitals were mutilated, and he had a raging staph infection, which he was obviously denied medical treatment for, and they found him dead. And then there was Jerome Murdo, who had been he was a former Marine, and he also, the headline was that he was cooked in his cell, 101 degrees, 56 years old, and had been on a psychiatric drug that had, you know, heat warnings on it. and he died. And then Scott Jones is something that I've been following very closely. I got an anonymous call a couple of weeks ago about a man named Scott Jones who was at the Nathan Klein Institute, Rockland State Psychiatric Facility in New York, on the CREF unit, and that he was dead at age 56, and that he was described to me as a nice, sweet, quiet man. And so right now it's my understanding there's an investigation going on about that, but I did a little bit of research, and the CREF unit stands for Research and Evaluation Facility. And so continuing research and evaluation facility. So it's at NKI's facility, which is a research facility. And so there's also questions about informed consent and what is going on in terms of informed consent. And then there are, you know, the murders like Kelly Thomas and others who are, you know, just barreled down. And these are what we know because the media has gotten to them. People have leaked video. There have been some kind of story. But in general, we don't know what's going on. The state or the federal governments do not release public information in these ways. In the 1850s, they recorded every death and reason for every death in the asylums. So if they have the technology to do that in 1850, why in 2014 we are not reporting on the deaths and the reasons for these deaths in these institutions? And then how many children? How many do we not know about? When you look at, like, Rebecca Riley, who at 2 years old was diagnosed and drugged and dead at 4, where her parents are found responsible for her as murder in the court, and the psychiatrist who prescribed the drugs is given immunity. What is going on in the society that we are allowing this fraud to continue to be perpetrated? There's a caller on line 585. Your line is open if you'd like to talk.
Hey, guys, how's it going? This is Chad out of New York State.
Hi, Chad.
Yes.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm pretty good. First-time listener to the show, just kind of tuning in to various channels and blog talk tonight. And I came across yours because yours seems to be kind of an open topic tonight, and I was just curious to know what you guys were talking about.
Oh, well, we've been talking about, in the last few minutes, we've been talking about different murders that have occurred by psychiatry, of people who were involuntarily involved with psychiatry. And then we've also been talking about the Murphy Bill, which is federal legislation that will create mandated involuntary outpatient commitment laws in all 50 states and wipe out protection and advocacy for individuals who are psychiatrically labeled and eliminate all alternatives at the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, alternatives to the medical model, all funding for any of that would be eliminated if this Murphy Bill passes. And so beginning of the show, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that food is the universal language, so maybe if we all eat really good food together, we'll all get along. I'm just kidding. No, I agree. I think that, I think there's a lot of problems in the world, but I'm not sure if you want me to go there. I am a Christian, and I love challenging people with my worldview, but I think I'm so narrow-minded, if you would, that I believe that the only answer to any of life's questions, you know, whether you're talking political, science, morality, logic, what have you, I think the only answer is that you start with God, and then the rest of the world will make sense with all of the craziness of the world.
Chad, you better not say that to a psychiatrist.
Are you a psychiatrist?
No, I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm a psychologist. But you better not say that to a psychiatrist. I'm like to say I'm an environmental.
I challenge everybody.
My special is environmental.
Everybody.
But in the, and I say that because there are many people who, because of their spiritual experiences, are diagnosed with either schizophrenia or psychosis or things like that. Mm. And so,
well, I would deny that. Yeah, I would deny that claim only because I think that there's a big difference calling yourself a spiritual or a, well, let's just take Christianity since it's what I am. I noticed that some people that call themselves Christians, they end up losing it, ended up divorcing, they end up even committing murder, and that they have a real problem with sin. Well, look, I'm not any more a Christian walking into a church than I am a burger walking into a Burger King. You know, if you're going to call yourself a Christian, that means you've surrendered your entire life to Christ Jesus. Now, whether you believe in that or not, I'm just telling you the difference between somebody who says, well, I'm a Christian and goes out and does weird things versus somebody who's a Christian and really lives the Christian life. So you can't really apply that to everybody.
Well, I think that psychiatry tends to. And so there's...
But that's wrong.
I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying that that's part of the problem, is that people who
right.
have deep religious beliefs or spiritual beliefs and believe that they are living in a way that they should be are sometimes diagnosed with schizophrenia or psychosis. A spiritual experience is, or believing that you can communicate with God, for example, it can be seen as somebody who is having that, and that's part of the problem. That's part of what they're hauling out right now is, and as a matter of fact, DJ Jaffe said it in the investigation hearings yesterday, that if somebody, you know, thinks they're the Messiah, that they need to be committed. And so that's an extreme example of the religious beliefs or spiritual experiences being cast out as psychiatric, but it routinely happens. And there's some, even in the research that I just finished, that came out, that one of the people was drugged because of their spiritual experience. When they told their experiences about God to the psychiatrist thought that they were, psychotic.
Mm-hmm. Now, where do you stand personally on things of the God worldview? I mean, are you a believer, not spiritual? Where do you sort of fall?
I have my own experiences and beliefs. That's about as much as I'm willing to say about it.
Sure. Well, I would challenge you and say, you know, since you're in a psychiatry, you're studying the mind. You're probably studying even sociology. You know, the study of
I don't study I'm not a psychiatrist.
Okay, you studied psychology.
Environmental psychology, yes.
Okay, and just give me a quick definition of what environmental psychology is.
A common definition is something around interactions, transactions people have in and with their environments. I looked at institutions, power, oppression, ecological psychology were things that I focused on in my studies.
What do you think of the following statement? You can be right in believing what you want as long as you truly believe it. Do you think that might be true for everybody?
You can be right in believing what you want as long as you truly believe it?
Yeah, that's a pretty common thing I run into. Or they'll say, you can believe what you want, I'm sure it's right, but I believe something different, so don't interfere with that.
Well, I think beliefs are funny in those ways because, you know, that's the thing is that people believe things individually. And I think everybody has their own truths that they have to come to. And so, I words like right are confusing sometimes because it suggests consensus reality. And so there's a lot of subjectivity to our experiences, and our experiences are definitely mediated by our environments. And so,
interesting. So do you think that experiences creates subjective realities?
I think it goes both ways.
Do you think there's any right and wrong?
Do I think there's right and wrong?
Is there a right and wrong?
Yeah, I think there's right and wrong.
How do you determine that? Like, give me an example of what you think is right and what is wrong.
I think something that is wrong is like forceful intervention on somebody or something. Mm-hmm. I think that things like child abuse or, you know, those are things that are clearly wrong.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say clearly wrong, you would go to another country, for instance, and you would tell them, you can't do that, that's wrong. Would you tell somebody how they ought to behave based on your opinions or worldview?
Well, it's kind of, I don't know. I think it would depend on the situation and where I was. I can tell you that when it comes to things like forced psychiatry, I clearly say that I think that is wrong, and I do everything that I can to make it sure that those things don't happen to people.
But it's based on subjective opinions.
Based on science. No, it's based on science.
Oh, what is the... Okay, that's interesting you said that. And what do you mean that it's based on science? What has science done to explain these things?
Well, it's what it's
just,
not.
I'm,
that,
I'm
that's
really,
that's
really,
interesting
really
that you put it that
curious.
Way. Because it's not based on what it's done. It's based on what it hasn't done. And what it hasn't done is shown any evidence of any kind of actual biological etiology. And what it has done is shown that there is, since you're a new listener, I'll just let you know this. I'm entirely for informed consent when it comes to psychiatry. I think that people should be able to do whatever drugs they want to do with informed consent, that they have options and choices and that they have all of the information about it. For about a third of people who are involved with psychiatry, they find help some type of help in it at different periods of time. But for the overwhelming majority of people, they do not. And what the science shows is that these drugs cause major diseases such as like metabolic syndrome or diabetes, kidney, liver failure, tardive dyskinesia, neuroleptic malignant syndrome, on and on, so forth. So when I say based on science, it's based on the science that is showing all of the negative ramifications of the psychiatric drugs and the lack of science that they have to justify the use of any of this.
Well, let me throw something out at you just to see. But I mean, I really do think it might sound like over the phone I'm being very malicious or condescending, but I'm really not. I hope you're not judging me as a person. I'm certainly not with you.
We're just having a conversation.
I really am. Okay, good. Have you ever thought about this? And I'm just throwing this out here, okay? From a scientific standpoint, when we reason, when we come up with conclusions, all right, we are using logic, for instance, as a tool. It's kind of a makes the furniture of the universe, right? I'm sure you've heard that in the scientific community. Logic is necessary. Oh, we got another person online?
I shouldn't be yet. I didn't hit the one, so theoretically I'm not online. So this is Dan.
Hi, Dan.
No,
how are you doing?
Jen.
Yep.
Hi, I didn't hit one, so but I guess I'm online. Hi.
Hi, but you're on. So, go ahead, Jen.
Dan. Yeah. Dan, if you're not a Seattle Seahawks fan, you have to get off the air.
Oh, let's not be too bossy yet there, boss. So please continue.
I'm just kidding.
Thanks,
with you, Dan. Welcome. Logic does make the furniture of the universe because it's necessary and it's unchangeable. I mean, we couldn't even have a conversation if we didn't have a necessary logic to go along with our reasoning. It's what makes us disagree with one another. It identifies everything. The law, for instance, of identity, that exists. It's a real reality. Except when you look at logic, and I sure hope that you've looked into this, because logic in itself is not material. You can't put it in my hand. You can't eat it. You can't grow it. It's not a chemical. It is an immaterial reality. It's necessary. It's intelligent. And it's unchangeable. So you actually have a source out there. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because I personally think it's important, Host, that people understand there is objective world out there that's governed by God. And if it's not governed by God, then we don't know what anything is.
Well, that's definitely a perspective. And so I think that is a perspective that many people share. But I think that logic is also something that tells you, like, does this sound like a good thing to do or not? And the idea of when you weigh out all of the potential benefits and consequences of something and benefits and risks of something, that you say, is this the right way to go about doing this? Is this going to further, you know, improve things?
No. That's asking questions. No, logic is necessary and it's the truth. For instance, the law of non-contradiction means opposites cannot be true at the same time in the same sense. Okay, that's true. We reason to conclusions using this particular reality. I'm not talking about asking and using philosophical questioning here. I'm talking about it is part of the philosophical thinking, but it is the necessary component, okay? It's a tool that we use to be able to come up with the conclusions at all. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just trying to get to what you're trying to ask then.
Well, how? Let me ask, based on your worldview, because you really haven't given me much what you believe in, because you chose not to tell me what it is that you believe spiritually or non-spiritually. I can't account for that. All I can give you is a very interesting Bible verse, and it says that all people know God exists, but they suppress the truth and unrighteousness. In other words, we know through God, and if you read on, it goes on, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but what it says is that through God's attributes and his qualities, his very character and nature, we're able to know he exists. And I thought about that, and I said, you know, what in the world does that mean? Well, when I looked into it deeper, really, the life we live right now, the fact, Host, that you're giving conclusions and your thoughts, your likes, your dislikes, your rights and your wrongs, is because you are made in the image of God. You're able to use morality because God's very nature is moral.
If you start having a conversation like this with a typical psychiatrist, they will immediately start to suspect that there is some kind of delusional pattern going on here and that there is some kind of intense problem that needs to be delved out at.
So that's very judgmental on psychiatrists.
Oh, well, yes. By their nature, they are to judge There's not a drop of evidence, Chad. There's no DNA scan. There's no genetic scan. There's no blood test. There's no brain scan.
No. What I'm asking you is, what basis are they using to determine that I'm delusional?
The basis is they are the due authority who gets to decide. They are the decider of who goes in one category or another. It's legal, and they got through school, and they have their diploma on the wall, and they're hired.
Wait, Dan, do you agree with
they
that?
They are the authority, and that's the base. That is a major part of their basis.
Dan, do you agree with that?
To do so. So I agree with that. Not very much.
I'm very confused on your two positions. You guys are not defending the psychiatrist, or you are?
No, not at all.
You're not defending.
Not at all. Not in any way. Not in any way, Chad. No, where's let me speak for myself. I'm saying that this is a huge part of the problem, and I'm glad that you called and brought it up, because this is part of the problem, that when somebody has a belief, regardless of what that belief is, and I'm in no way challenging your beliefs, but whatever it is somebody believes, that the psychiatrist as authority and assigner has the legal right to determine whether or not your beliefs need to be drugged away and whether or not you need to be locked away because of your beliefs.
I see.
And
okay.
That's the problem. Yeah.
Yeah, and let me go back for one moment. Okay, just I would clarify that more to the audience, just because on this whole time I'm thinking I'm talking to your thoughts and your opinions this whole time, but really what you're doing is you're using kind of a third-person view of this particular psychiatrist who you do not agree with. And that's fine. That's, you know, this is your radio show and this is what you want to talk about, but I wasn't clear what exactly you're defending. Okay, so now I know that you're not defending the psychiatrist. You are actually sort of against it.
Yes, and when I said that, I guess because you don't know me, and I should have been a little bit more cautious. I was saying this tongue in cheek, kind of, when I said you need to be careful about this, because this is the entire a big part of the problem.
Sure.
Is that whatever somebody believes about themselves, about their experiences, about even who they can be, like for instance, people who like maybe want to be a writer or a musician are told that that's delusional and that they need to like be a cashier and like live on SS, you know, on disability. do you know what I mean?
I hope people aren't doing that out there. I'm sure they are because they think they have authority, but that's not right, and that's. And I'll say this one other thing, and I'll let you go because I know that you have a show to run here and I don't want to take up all this time. But I would say that look at a person's worldview. Okay, when I'm having debates or I'm having a discussion with people, let's say an atheist, they'll say that the world, maybe you're an atheist, I don't know, but this is what I run into. Well, the world is subjective because we come from the Big Bang. You know, we come from evolution. We're nothing but material. Well, if we're nothing more than material, then there's no basis to believe in any right and wrongs, as Richard Dawkins said. Actually, Richard Dawkins said in one of his books that the universe has the properties we would expect if there is at bottom no purpose and no design, no good and no evil. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Except when Richard Dawkins goes home, he's going to pay his bills, he's going to love his wife, he's going to use logic, he's going to use morality as he knows it. And that's because every one of us is made in the image of God. So if a psychiatrist is saying, I don't like your worldview, I think you're delusional, and I may have to put an end to that, how do I know that you're not delusional? I mean, we're all just molecules in motion. Really, to you, we're just bags of protoplasm floating around the universe. How do you know what's right and wrong? And I think Dan made a good point. He said, well, because they have the education and the diploma on their wall to prove it. And I think that's absolute BS.
It is, and it's all based in fraud. I mean, that diploma that the psychiatrist, I mean, a psychiatrist is a medical doctor who's done a short period of time as a resident on a psych unit. That's what gives them the right to be a psychiatrist. And there is, the entire thing is fraudulent from bottom up. And it is propagated by the media and by the pharmaceutical industry and all of these people. Like 50% of the country, at least, in a study I saw recently, thinks that there's a biological base to psychiatric labels, which has never been shown. So where is half of the country at least getting this information from? And they're getting it from all of these sources of fraud that are profiting hugely. I mean, earlier we mentioned that like Abilify as a drug itself has made over $7 billion. Just that one drug.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are all of these, you know, that has all of these side effects and risks and potential and a squelching of people's beliefs and dreams and desires and understandings of the world. And so I have no interest in debating what anybody's particular beliefs are, But I truly believe that people should be able to believe whatever they want to believe without being subjected to being drugged and locked up. And especially when those beliefs are spiritual beliefs. And I think that that's something that enough society is not well-informed and misinformed, intentionally misinformed by the, you know, and so this Murphy bill that they're pushing now that would, you know, eliminate alternatives and eliminate advocacy and all of this other stuff and institutionalize a national involuntary commitment mandate rides on the idea that people, you know, when they throw out the person that they're talking about, they routinely will throw out somebody who's having a spiritual experience as somebody who needs to be locked up. And I think that that's just wrong. I think it's, and I don't think psychiatry has any business making these kinds of decisions about people.
I will give you a quick story, which it kind of goes along with this. I think it's all part of the system personally, but this really doesn't have anything to do with spirituality. It's medical, actually. My wife has a condition that's autoimmune, and a lot of people have healed it. Okay, I'm sure you've heard of Crohn's. It's a form of Crohn's.
Okay.
And, you know, we had to go see a specialist because she got really ill 1 year. It was, you know, probably a good 10, 11 years now, when she had this. And we went and we talked to the doctor. They brought us to a specialist that deals with digestive issues and things like that. And he looked at the case and, you know, instead of sending us to an acupuncturist or talking about natural foods that we can really hold on to and use to get her healed. Instead, he gives her this pill, you know, that's chemical. She takes 9 pills a day for it. And for what? It doesn't heal her. It doesn't do anything. It's as if people are just, these psychiatrists and these doctors are sort of just, by law, they're in chains to do what the devil wants them to do. And it's really... it has nothing to do with really coming up with solutions for people. You're depressed? Okay, I'll tell you what we'll do. Let's get some Taxol in you. Taxol will take care of that. That's just, it's silly, but that's what they do. It's like no solution. Just give them a bunch of drugs, and hopefully, you know, you never hear from that person again.
Unfortunately, that's right, and that's what we're trying to expose here. And so when I talk about psychiatry, that's the exact perspective that I'm coming from. There is nothing beneficial going on here for the majority of people. And again, if people want to do drugs, do whatever drugs you want to do. But when it comes to involuntary injections, where people are being injected with a drug that lasts for 30 days, or they have a medication prompter coming and showing up at their house to make sure that they're taking their drugs, and are, you know, or just locked up in an institution because they won't comply with. And it doesn't offer a solution. A pill is not going to fix a deep-seated, often either trauma-based or some kind of spiritual crisis or an emotional loss of a loved one or a bad breakup or a loss of a job. A pill is not going to fix any of these things. A pill is, if somebody is, homeless, a pill is not going to suddenly develop a roof over their head. And it's a scam, and it's a big money-making scam.
Yeah. On the other hand, if people have undiagnosed problems or diagnosed problems, depending on what's in the pill, a pill could help. But the way capitalism has it now, psychiatry is particularly bad because they diagnose people by just selecting people into behavioral and psychological categories and then calling that the diagnosis when they have no medical idea what's happening with anyone, because it's a non-medical selection of people into descriptive categories without that preclude diagnosis. If there's a medical diagnosis, you don't get the psychiatric label. So, but in the pills that they give, like antidepressant pills, antipsychotic, like other pills in medicine, they more or less suppress symptoms So it also, and by suppressing, giving a quick label and then giving a lucrative pill that suppresses symptoms but doesn't get to the underlying problem, that allows them to have, if they can get a patent on a pill and sell a lot of it, and then they've made a success of themselves because they've got a successful product in the stock market and for their investors and stock and the people who own stock and the company owners and CEOs and so forth. And so it doesn't just apply to psychiatry. It's in other branches of medicine as well. So if you have cholesterol-lowering drugs, then if you can make money off them, you don't necessarily want to find out the medical causes of high cholesterol and get people well. You want to sell cholesterol-lowering drugs. And so it applies in heart medicine and other kinds of medicine. So the good news is that with the Internet, you can find a lot of good information on Google and so forth. You can look around for information that goes beyond label and drug to finding out underlying problems and restorative care, restorative treatment. And so for psychiatry and medicine, there's a pretty good group called Psyche Truth. That's like Psyche with an E, Truth, one word, psychetruth.com. And they've got these videos like with Vincent Blonzi. He's got some great videos, and he's doing like a live chat where people type in messages and he answers them for an hour. And also he's got videos on there and Psyche Truth. It's Vincent Blonzi. He's got this one that's called Alternative Functional Medicine, Vincent Blonzi, and he talks about many doctors, you know, doing a quick label and drug. They tell you what your disease label is and give you the matching drug. And he's saying, like, well, you know, the drugs are good in the short term, perhaps, but really you want restorative care to try to bring a person to a state of wellness where they don't need a drug.
Right, and, you know, one of the things that was said at the hearings today by DJ Jaffe was that things like trauma-informed care and peer support don't work. And, you know, what we know is that upwards of 96% of people who are in state-operated facilities have a childhood history of physical or sexual abuse. And so a pill is not going to solve a long-term trauma response. People need to be able to have alternatives in ways that they are, you know, being able to heal themselves that don't include the drugs. Celia, who was on before, just posted a link onto my page about the article that she was talking about. And so the title is, "Nearly Every Mass Shooting in the Last 20 Years Shares One Thing in Common, and It Isn't Weapons." And so then they go on listing all of these mass shootings with all of these kids who were on either Ritalin or the SSRIs, Paxil, Celexa, so on and so forth. All of these, just a huge list of people who all were on these psychiatric drugs. And we need to be looking at and mandating that the federal government start holding hearings about these SSRIs and what young people are being put on. What adults also, obviously, but young people especially, and the long-term effects that they're having on our society and on the individual really needs to be exposed. And I think, Dan, was it you that was saying about any medical, that this is something that goes beyond psychiatry, that this is a issue in medicine in general, of where people are just so quick to take a drug and not do things to create a healthier lifestyle for themselves, and the long-term effects of these drugs, we still don't know. And, you know, for people who are listening who may not know that, like, drugs like Paxil or the SSRIs were only tested by the FDA for 6 to 8 weeks. They were not meant to be drugs that people were on long-term. So any of the testing that we have as far as ramifications, consequences, you know, negative side effects, all we know is from a 6 to 8 week test. And there are people who have been on these drugs for literally decades at this point. And, it hampers the human soul in so many ways, and I really do think it's criminal.
Very interesting.
So, Dan, you were just calling to listen. Do you have anything you'd like to add to the conversation or something else you wanted to maybe talk about?
As far as, another person that's very good is this Dr. McCullough. There's also a video that you might want to look up. You know, and you could type in Google McCullough or Vincent Bolanzi and Crohn's disease or whatnot, and maybe perhaps find some in-depth stuff. And as far as the SSRI goes, one interesting thing is that the first SSRI that was a big super seller for a couple of years and was given a lot of publication was Prozac. It was like Time's Pill of the Year, wasn't it? Or Newsweek's. They made it instead of Person of the Year, it was Pill of the Year, and it had a big pill on the cover. And people were saying, well, it changes your personality to, like, but in a good way. It makes you a go-getter, a successful, non-depressed go-getter. And just, so personality makeover, you know, instead of like a facelift or something. Good stuff. And, you know, like, and they were promoting cocaine back then as well, and Valium for pretty well, and then news and media. But before you can have a blockbuster drug in the USA, it has to be FDA approved. So you have to create tests that you could submit to the FDA showing that your invention, your patented chemical, is a new invention of yours that's effective and safe, according to, and you have to have proper studies written up the correct way and journal published and so forth, and the FDA has to approve your drug for the market. And so there's a law firm called Baum Hedlund Law, who in litigation got secret documents that showed that prior to the FDA approving Prozac, the first SSRI, that the company in intercompany memos and from their testing knew that their drug was causing suicide. And their concern was to how to spin this and how to phrase themselves and how to present the tests and how to keep that under wraps so that they wouldn't jeopardize the sales and the approval. So Baum Hedlund Law. So they knew it was causing suicide. And then like 15 years after these things were on the market, they were still covering it up, of course.
Right. What was it,
but
like 04?
They were actually covering
or...
it up prior to it coming to market.
Right. What was it, like in 2004, 2005, that the black box warning went on, all the SSRIs?
Right. But they were aware before it was legalized by the FDA. They were aware by 1986 that their first SSRI was causing suicide.
And all for profit, right? All in the name of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, yep. as a society, we need to wake up, because people don't realize the damage that's being done, and people trust doctors. They trust, they trust the medical professions, that they have some authority, that they have some information that they don't have, and they're not given full informed consent.
Even the psychiatrists aren't given the proper information, because their leaders, such as Dr. Joseph Biderman and Janet Wozniak at Harvard, Wozniak and Joseph Biderman, caused the bipolar that caused a huge increase in toddlers and children being diagnosed as bipolar and given Risperdal and
killing them. And kids died in those studies. And kids were damaged in those studies.
Right.
I can say this like authoritatively, that I know of at least one person who was in those studies, McClellan studies in Washington, who to this day is still suffering major bodily injury from being put in those trials. And kids died in those trials, and we have all of these kids, thousands of kids are being drugged with Risperdal, and it makes me so mad. It makes me so mad. And
so,
nobody knows.
Grassley showed that Senator Grassley did a Senate probe and found out that Joseph Biderman and others were getting millions of dollars that was undeclared from drug companies. And meanwhile, they are the leading authorities in psychiatry at Harvard. They're like professors at Harvard, setting the standard for all the other psychiatrists in the land. And so with their journals rigged and with their professors being actually drug company employees, not even the psychiatrists like in your communities have the proper information or leadership.
It really is the same as like what Eli Lilly did with the Zyprexa, that they knew it caused diabetes and they didn't tell anybody. And or what the, you know, the cigarette companies did with the tobacco. And so people get up in arms about some things, but not about other things. It seems that, like, if you have a psychiatric history and these things are happening to you, you're expendable because of the larger discrimination that we face in this society, that we are less than human, that it's okay that these things happen. That I actually read in New York, the medical director, et cetera, in 2008, wrote that once the Zyprexa papers came out and it was exposed that Zyprexa caused diabetes, he wrote that diabetes is better than psychosis. And so last I checked, diabetes is something that can actually kill you. Psychosis is something that they can't actually prove exists. So how is something that can kill you better than something that can't be proved exists? I just don't get it. I really don't. And so I think that, you know, to be suspicious of the FDA, to, like we were talking about earlier about the electroshock and the device being an experimental device that they're thinking of just lowering to a safe device without any safety or efficacy testing, based on money, again, going back to this idea of capitalism as a big part of the problem. And today, DJ Jaffe, or yesterday, saying that he's an, quote, uber liberal and more liberal, you know, liberal as you get or something like that, and, you know, asking his Democrat colleagues to support this idea of force as valid and not, not an infringement on our civil liberties. It's a total infringement on our civil liberties. And the more people, people who consider themselves liberal, to allow this kind of behavior and encourage it and promote it and fund it, that this is the most unliberal idea that has ever existed. And it's not okay to do to us just because we've been assigned some fraudulent psychiatric label.
Who is speaking there? Tim Murphy, the Republican?
Congressman Murphy, he is a Republican, but on the panel today for the investigation, they had DJ Jaffe and Edward Kelly and Mike Weller, I think his name is, a forensic psychiatrist. But Jaffe is the one who's saying that he's uber liberal. And it's like, I'm sorry, but this is not, you know, and he's saying that it's okay to not be liberal about this because this is something that's real that needs to be controlled. And that, you know, somebody else said, you know, 6 feet under with their rights on. And it's like, people don't realize that they're saying that it's going to be this small little group of people that they're going to go after, which is unjust to begin with. But people don't realize that they can become part of that small little group in under 5 minutes. And it happens so quickly.
All you need is the person, the duly legal authority to select you as being in the category of person that needs to be observed or needs to be drugged or needs to be taken away or needs to have their gun rights or needs to be labeled as a person who's irrational or dangerous or disorderly, and then anyone can be put in that category that they want.
And so
the claiming, like, well, I'm a liberal, but anyone that the authority says needs to have their rights away needs to have their rights away because they are just such sick brain disease because the authority gave them a label, and therefore they need to have their rights taken away because they are one of those selected brain disease people who we should all pity. And it's like,
there's no evidence.
That can be applied to all they need. Right.
Not a shred of scientific evidence.
And yes, if they succeed in making this a psychiatric police state, then they can change their selection criteria to include people that may not have thought that they would be included.
Right. And so somebody, I was listening to another show earlier, and somebody called about concerns about their gun rights because their wife was diagnosed with postpartum depression. So what does this mean for them as a gun owner? And people don't realize what a slippery slope this is. This is how it has happened throughout history. They come for people with psychiatric disabilities first. When they wanted to start with eliminating soda, they took the soda machines out of the mental institutions. Then they took the candy machines. Then they took the cigarettes out. And slowly but surely, when you want to see where society is going to control next, look at the controls that are being put on mental institutions, because they pilot it there, and then they bring it to the universities, and then they bring it to the public. And so they're targeting groups of people to infringe on and make it okay. And it's okay that these people don't have their rights. They don't deserve to have their rights. And last I checked, in America, we all deserve to have that. We live under a constitution, and the idea of creating certain laws for certain groups of people, I think, is at the base of unconstitutionality.
Right on.
I think that's about where we're at. And so, do you have anything else you'd like to talk about? Because I'm going to start wrapping up pretty soon. We're almost out of time.
Well, my friend Eva Edelman, she wrote the book Natural Healing for Schizophrenia, and then I met her, and she wrote the book Natural Healing for Bipolar. And people that are taking the antipsychotic drugs, so-called, the dopamine blockade drugs, they might want to look up the Safe Harbor site, which is alternativementalhealth.com.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple articles on there, one by Charles Gant, which is Nutrient Protection from the Harms of Psychiatric Drugs. And so that recommends, antioxidants and so forth. And so people that are on medications, there's treatments for actual biochemical imbalances where they can actually test you and hopefully replace the drugs with restorative treatments, and there's also, as I say, there's some protection from some of the harms if you likewise. So
right.
Safe Harbor, I recommend Safe Harbor, the www.alternativementalhealth.com, and in particular Charles Gant's article.
Right, and I just want to mention this, since we're bringing this up. If you are somebody who may be taking psychiatric drugs and or just learning about this, do your own research. Go find your own information and then make some decisions. And to understand that while there may not be something chemical going on prior to taking a drug, once you introduce a drug to the situation, you have changed the chemical makeup. And people very often think that there's nothing wrong with these drugs because they're legal and prescribed and that they're different than street drugs, but they're no different in terms of the withdrawal that they cause when people try to come off of them. And coming off can be a really difficult thing. And I just want to point people to www.willhall.net /coming-off-meds. There you will find a harm reduction guide to coming off psychiatric drugs and withdrawal, and it's some really good information to read if you're thinking about making these kinds of decisions, and to know that there are supports that are available in coming off, but that it is never suggested to come off immediately and quickly, because like any other drug, there's a withdrawal that people wind up going through. The guide is also translated in Spanish, German, Greek, Bosnian, Croatian, Japanese, Italian, French, Norwegian, and Czech. And there's a ton of information. There were, I think, over 56-member health professional advisory board in developing this guide, and that there are alternatives and vitamins and other kinds of supplements, and then also the importance of trauma-informed care and healing, from emotional crises that you may have had or experiences that you may have had. Vets coming back, I'm hearing of vet veterans being electroshocked and drugged for having witnessed things in war, an unnatural state. And so the idea that there are supports for people and there are alternative ways of going about doing things. Psychiatry doesn't necessarily have all of these answers, and there certainly is a wealth of information about how psychiatry is damaging to many people. And then the double issues of the loss of our civil liberties, and how quickly, if the Murphy Bill, H.R. 3717, is to pass, how quickly the entire face of the psychiatric system will change and will be reverted back to days of asylums and institutionalization for all, because their belief is that we don't belong walking on the same streets as they do. And that is a big problem. Dan, I want to thank you for calling in, and could you give that website one more time?
Safe Harbor, www.alternativementalhealth.com.
Great. Thanks. And Celia and Chad and all others who have been listening and texting to me back and forth as the show is going on, thank you so much for your time and for listening. If you have an idea for a show or would like to be a guest or have a news tip that you think needs to be investigated, you can call the Talk with Tenney tip line 24 hours a day at area code 718-273-8708. That's area code 718-273-8708. And we will be on again tomorrow night from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. And I want to thank you all for listening. And until I talk to you next time, keep on talking. Talk to you soon.
Great job, Lauren.
Thanks, Dan.